Members, we have a long day today. After the sitting, we will resume at 6 until 8:30, and even tomorrow, so that on Friday we adjourn early. We hopefully would have finished with the public hearings already. Let's start. Good morning, everybody. Today we are proceeding with the public hearings on the gender-based, the three gender-based violence bills. We will be getting a presentation from Freedom of Religion in South Africa. You have 20 minutes in, for your presentation. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Let's see if I can get the screen sharing right. Can everyone see the slideshow?
Yes, we can see. We can see. It's very nice.
Okay, wonderful. All right. Honourable Chair and other members of the committee, thank you for inviting 4SA to participate in this meeting and to present our input on the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill. We trust that our submission and this presentation will assist the committee in drafting a law that practically benefits our women and children and makes the protection of the law accessible to the most vulnerable in society. I am Daniela Ellebeck, an attorney and the legal advisor to Freedom of Religion South Africa, or 4SA. I also apologize on behalf of my colleagues, 4SA's Executive Director Michael Swain, and 4SA's legal counsel, Advocate Nadine Bardenholz, who are unable to attend. 4SA is a legal advocacy organization working to protect and promote the right to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief, and opinion. In this presentation, simply referred to as the right to religious freedom, which is a constitutional right found in Section 15 of our Bill of Rights. Now, our Constitutional Court has defined religious freedom as the right to entertain such religious beliefs as a person chooses, the right to declare religious beliefs openly and without fear of hindrance or reprisal, and the right to manifest religious belief by worship and practice or by teaching or dissemination. It further also said that freedom of religion implies an absence of coercion or constraint and may be impaired by measures that force people to act or refrain from acting in a manner contrary to their religious beliefs. So, in other words, religious freedom is the right to believe as you want to believe and the right to freely live out that belief by words and actions. In a nutshell, therefore, it is everyone's freedom to say and do what they believe, and on the flip side, to not be forced into saying or doing something they do not believe. It applies to everyone equally at all times, and it is not a right that one leaves behind when one goes to work in the morning, but you carry it with you into wherever you may go in the public realm. Because it attaches to you as a person, as a human being, not a place you may be in or a function you do. Now, our Constitutional Court has also said that this right protects even those beliefs that are bizarre, illogical, or irrational to others, or are incapable of scientific proof, and that it is a right that is especially important for our constitutional democracy, which is based on human dignity, equality, and freedom. Importantly, religion, conscience, and belief are also equality rights. In other words, grounds in terms of which someone cannot be unfairly discriminated against in Section 9 of the Constitution, either by the state or any other person. 4SA's interest in this bill is therefore limited to those aspects of the bill that could have unintended direct or indirect consequences on the constitutional right to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief, and opinion, and or on the equality rights of religion, conscience, and belief. And our presentation, which will hopefully be brief, will be limited to these aspects, which are more fully covered in our written submission submitted to the committee. Turning to 4SA's comments on the bill, at the outset, now that we've covered what the right to religious freedom is, I wish to clearly state that it is impossible to hide a criminal act behind the cloak of religious freedom. A crime remains a crime, irrespective of whether it is committed by the postman, policeman, or pastor. Some committee members may have heard us say this before in a different context. When it comes to this bill, we commend the legislature in being part of the multi-pronged strategy to end gender-based violence. Furthermore, we agree with and support the bill's purpose in broad. As stated in our written submission, we are, however, very concerned about certain provisions of the bill that would potentially negatively affect and or interfere with constitutional rights to religious freedom, which, as explained before, our highest court has already defined as including the protection of the beliefs of others, which we ourselves may deem to be bizarre, illogical, or irrational. This concern becomes evident when we look at the wording of particular clauses in the bill. Turning to, for example, Clause 2D, definition of controlling behavior. Controlling behavior means the complaint or a complainant or a related person to be dependent on or subordinate to the respondent by A, isolating him or her from sources of support, B, exploiting his or her resources for personal gain, C, depriving him or her of the means needed for independence, resistance, or escape, or D, regulating his or her everyday behavior. Now, this current definition is problematic in that it includes D, regulating his or her everyday behavior. When in many domestic relationships, as defined by the bill, it is common, for example, for parents to regulate the behavior of their children, or for an employer whose domestic worker or other employee lives on the same premises to do so in respect of his or her employee. This is not necessarily controlling behavior in the sense contemplated by the bill. This is especially true when, turning to parental rights, one remembers that parents are the holders of these parental rights in terms of international instruments that Africa has ratified, and which allow them to guide their child's upbringing, and therefore they often fall within the broader umbrella of religious freedom. Also, in terms of Section 18.2 of the Children's Act, parents are given the responsibility for safeguarding and promoting the well-being of the child, protecting their child from exploitation and any other physical, emotional, or moral harm. Honourable Committee, it is submitted that this is only possible for parents to fulfil these legal responsibilities that the South African government expects of them if they can regulate their child's everyday behaviour. As a result, 4SA proposes that the definition be tightened further by removing the phrase regulating everyday behaviour, which should remove the problem of the bill inadvertently and unintentionally affecting parental rights. Turning to the definition of domestic violence found in the bill, domestic violence definition now includes, amongst other things, spiritual abuse, as well as coercive behavior and controlling behavior, which were on the previous slide. Now, read with the bill's definition of spiritual abuse, which is A, ridiculing or insulting the complainant's religious or spiritual beliefs, B, preventing the complainant from practicing his or her spiritual beliefs, or C, using the complainant's religion or spiritual beliefs to control, manipulate, or shame him or her, including using religious texts or beliefs as a pretext to justify, minimize, or rationalize abusive behavior. This clause is of especial concern to 4SA. As already stated, it is impossible to hide a criminal act behind the cloak of religious freedom. A crime remains a crime, irrespective of whether it is committed by the postman, policeman, or pastor. Therefore, all religious organizations, such as churches, and religious leaders, such as pastors, must operate under the rule of law, and if they contravene existing laws, they commit a crime and must be prosecuted. Similarly, the normal principles of defeating or obstructing the course of justice and vicarious liability apply. Thus, the inclusion of spiritual abuse in the definition of domestic violence is unnecessary, because the behavior in question is already prohibited by a multitude of existing laws. 4SA has written extensively on how these laws can be applied to combat situations that arise within a religious organization and context. And these articles were annexed to our written submission made to this committee. To name but a few examples of such existing laws, the Principal Act, the Domestic Violence Act, which could have been used in circumstances such as the Seven Angels cult and the resulting tragedy in the Kobo Eastern case, because it is capable of being used by people suffering abuse at the hands of religious organizations or cults due to the wide definition of both domestic relationships and domestic violence, and which allows protection not only against physical abuse, which would be the crime of assault, but also, amongst other things, emotional, verbal, and psychological abuse, intimidation, harassment, in other words, a pattern of conduct that induces the fear of harm, and controlling behavior that causes imminent harm to the safety, health, or well-being of the person. It is also worth mentioning that this particular case also involved sex trafficking, possession of illegal firearms, armed robbery, and even murder. This is evidently not anything that even vaguely resembles a church and or religious association, but was in fact a criminal organization and can only be properly be called a criminal gang. Furthermore, there's also the Intimidation Act 72 of 1982, which makes it a criminal offense to force someone to do or not to do something something by intimidating them with violence or threats of violence, punishable with up to a decade's imprisonment. There's also the Consumer Protection Act 68 of 2008, which covers instances of manipulation and or exploitation, the Protection from Intimidation and Harassment Act, Promotion of Equality, Prevention of Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, which also prohibits harassment, and then, of course, the various common law crimes, including but not limited to assault, including sexual assault, and assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, assault GBH. Now, many committee members may recall the story of the infamous Prophet of Doom, who sprayed his congregants with the pesticide doom. He was found guilty of 4 counts of assault GBH, as well as guilty of contravening the Fertilizers, Farm Feeds, Agricultural Remedies, and Stock Remedies Act. Now, although this situation didn't take place in a domestic setting, such as envisaged by the book, it is an example of how existing laws can be successfully applied. One also then gets the common law crimes of rape, administration of poison, culpable homicide, attempted murder, fraud, murder, and so forth. Now, the fact that these existing crimes are committed within a supposedly religious context does not change the matter. It remains a crime even when the victim is a willing participant. Because South Africa's criminal law protects the public interest too, not just the interest of a consenting person. This means that the state has an interest in prosecuting all activities that are against the law, in other words, crime. By way of analogy, a law says that even if you specifically ask someone to kill you in the event of assisted suicide, the person who killed you is guilty of the crime of murder. The state, because it has a duty to protect the public interest, has an interest in bringing all criminals to justice for all crimes, even where your consent, example, to be killed, was to your own detriment. In most cases, the consent given is not true consent because it was not given voluntarily. Rather, it was the result of coercion. None of this is considered legally to amount to consent. In addition to the crimes already being covered by existing laws, the definition of spiritual abuse is also problematic because it attempts to create a separate category of abuse for actions which very comfortably fits into the general definition of abuse and or which are already covered by the provisions relating to, for example, emotional abuse and so forth. This is unnecessary. Controlling, manipulative, intimidatory, harassing, etc. behavior is illegal, despite of how it is dressed up, whether religious or otherwise. The definition is also confusing and muddies the waters because instead of focusing on the type of behavior that is problematic, it focuses on what that behavior attempts to disguise itself as. In light of this, 4SA recommends that when religious practices are conducted in a manner that is harmful, criminal, or otherwise unlawful, the answer remains effective enforcement of relevant existing laws, even where such abuse occurs in the domestic setting. In conclusion, to sum up, 4SA recommends in particular that spiritual abuse should be removed from the book because the definition is unnecessary, as the harm that is defined in this definition and that this definition is trying to legislate is already prohibited by a multitude of existing laws which ought to be enforced. Thank you for allowing 4SA to present our concerns and recommendations to this honourable committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, ma'am. I will now open for two members of questions for clarity. We have 30 minutes to do that, honorable members. Can you remove this presentation so that I can be able to see members?
I stopped the screen share, Chair, so you shouldn't be seeing anything from my side at all.
Thank you very much. I have now the following members who would want to ask questions. Honorable Horn, Werner Horn, Honorable Yuli Swayako. Those are the two members who have indicated. Honorable Swart will be the third person to ask questions. And then also I have Honorable Kubu Dele Janji, Honorable Ivo Bachens. Who's the other one?
That's it, Chair.
That's it. Okay. Let's start with Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to colleagues and to the presenters. Chair, I want to focus on the let's say the general theme within the presentation, to the effect that it is the view of the presenters that certain of the definitions and proposals would serve to undermine could serve to undermine religious freedom, and I firstly want them. Would request them to address us on the issue of the balancing of rights, which is in play here. So I want to say that I think there's general agreement within South Africa that the scourge, or even as it has been called, the second pandemic we faced with as a country relating to gender-based violence, of which a large portion happens in a domestic scene, whether that won't in any event justify a certain limitation of other rights in order to address this. That's the one issue I think we must wrestle with in this regard. And whilst I appreciate that their focus, obviously being the institution they are, is in protecting religious freedoms, I want to receive their comments as to whether they wouldn't agree that in the circumstances a certain limitation to other rights wouldn't be justified in order to address this so-called second pandemic. The second issue, however, Chair, I want to also address is that through their work in looking at religious freedom, whether they have considered the manner in which religious freedom is to a large extent sometimes abused, and I'm not singling out a single religion. I think if one has to be fair, it could be found in more or less all of the major religions prevalent in South Africa today. And if I say abused, I don't even want to say it is a mainstream tendency, but it is in fact a tendency where specifically the dominant role of men are protected through the way in which the specific religions are practiced by certain sections of those religions, the dominant role of men, and then by extension even if only in a tacit or silent manner, the fact that men are seen as the head of both women and children, and that would by extension give them a certain authority or justification to act in specifically the ways which the different definitions, which is then questioned by the institution, foresees that it is problematic. So coercive behavior to the extent that a man would be able to say, but the God we are all serving has ordained me to be your head, and therefore you must listen to me. So where do we find that balance to say these practices, if we hopefully agree, are practices that is not to be justified in a constitutional democracy. That's now apart from the fact that within the different religions, not everybody is even in agreement that this is the way households specifically should function. How do we find the balance? And in the light of this problem, is the institution still insistent that these specific definitions and proposals are problematic? Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Honorable Hoan. Honorable Liako.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I wish to apologize to the previous speakers. What I have to say basically has nothing to do with their presentation. However, yesterday I was quite a bit disturbed that our very first presentation was by the ANC Women's League. And I know that I made a comment about it, but I also think that we as the EFF have made submissions, and I don't see our name as part of the delegation that will make presentations. So I would like to know, how is the choice of who makes presentations in front of the committee done? Because I know for a fact that even our Deputy Secretary General did make submissions to the committee, and I don't think we've been invited to come and make our submissions publicly as part of the public hearings. So I think that is what I would like to know, because for me it doesn't seem to be then quite fair that we have some political parties making presentations and others not being given the opportunity. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Liako. When we advertise for public hearings, we do indicate that parties or people who want to make public representations can so indicate, because others are happy just by making a submission without indicating that or without wanting to come and make an oral representation. Everybody who wants to make oral representation is allowed to come and make oral representation, but they should indicate that in addition to their written representation, then they would want to also make oral representation. If the EFF is of the view that, no, they want to change and now want to come for oral representation, that would be fine. There is no transmesh. But there is no organization or persons that are being favored over the others. Everyone who indicates that he or she is willing to come and make oral representation, we are happy to lender to oblige. This is participatory democracy.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry to make a debate, but with your permission, I would like to then submit that we did say that we wanted to make oral presentations, and we still want to make oral presentations to the committee. And if we could be allowed that opportunity, it would be quite opportunistic. I mean, it would be quite welcome for us to be able to make those submissions as the EFF.
Can you make that follow-up with the committee secretary so that you can be included?
She's right. It will be quite opportunistic, Chair. She's right.
It's not. It's English bundles have left me.
Honorable members, let's focus on the issue at hand. We have resolved the matter. They would make a follow-up with the committee secretariat. And if they want to make representations, oral representation, they'll be allowed to do so. So let's proceed to Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation, and thank you for your support for the role that the legislature is playing in fighting gender-based violence. I appreciate that you focused on a very narrow ambit, but I presume you then are in full support of the other provisions of the legislation that we are dealing with. But just then on the specific issues, and you've been asked some tough questions from Mr. Horn, which are important to deal with in the light of gender-based violence. I think what is key to me is looking carefully at whether it is necessary to include the definition of spiritual abuse, given the fact that it is covered by other legislation. And that I'd like you to just unpack a little bit about that a little bit further, because I appreciate your legal argument that if it is covered in other legislation, is it really necessary to be covered in this particular series of bills, in this bill? But is it not another consideration that many victims would not know that they already have the protection under other pieces of legislation? And it could be that by inserting it here, that it highlights that where anyone is subject to unlawful spiritual abuse, whatever the nature is, that it then gives them the ambit that they know. Is it not something to consider a belt and braces approach, or is there serious concerns about it being inserted here? So it could be that it informs people in general. And then could I also just ask a more general question? We have been struggling with the scourge of gender-based violence in the nation. It's a second pandemic, but would you like to comment on the role that religious organizations can play in combating gender-based violence in general, given the fact that the organization represents various religions and religious organizations and has many, many representatives, as you set out in your, or millions of people that might subscribe to understanding religious values and the role that it can play as well, and from a positive side, to combat gender-based violence? What is the role of churches, mosques, synagogues in speaking out against this scourge? So a lot of emphasis has been placed that it can't only be the legislature, law enforcement that deal with this. This is a societal issue. And we've got many civil society organizations that have made, like yourselves, have made inputs and are monitoring and assisting us with this issue. So civil society plays a key role, and maybe you'd just like to comment on what greater role can religious organizations play in this. Sorry. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Honorable Kobu Dele Janje.
Thank you very much to Freedom of Religion South Africa, 4SA, very nice name. Chair, maybe before I go to the three critical issues I want to raise with them, I just saw in the meeting, so you might want to make that comment. I'm quite happy that today we seem to be joined by our colleagues from the Portfolio Committee on Women and Gender. It's quite appreciated, who are part of us. They are quiet, but they are here. It's quite appreciable that it looks a very collaborative effort. I thought at some point you might want to make that comment to them, to welcome them. That's the first issue, Chair, I want to raise. The second issue, I think I'm largely covered by Honorable Horn. And I'll be interested to hear a response to those questions. But perhaps in addition to what Honorable Horn was raising, let me just, firstly, on the first issue of undue pressure, because you are proposing that we do away with this definition. And there's no alternative provided by yourself. In the place of this, what are you advocating? What are you asking this committee to do? You've gone silent on that issue. And I don't think you can only come here to pray for certain things to be removed. And when they are removed, we are left with a vacuum. I would want to invite you to share your thoughts, that when you argue, because now, Chair, this is very becoming, it's helping us in terms of the text and how we're going to have to amend if we need to amend. And so it's important to get the thoughts of those that come in front of us to really in detail share with us, because as I sit here, I'm still not convinced about the need for us to do away with the undue pressure kind of definition. And worse or so, in the absence of an alternative issue towards that. So I'm really inviting you in to in the time the chair will give you to say what is it that you want us to do alternatively to that. That's the first issue, Chair. The second one relates to their second prayer for us to remove spiritual abuse. I think on that one, we are if currently in an environment where leave alone the issue of Kwasi Zamantu, the allegations that are coming out of that, lots of those allegations from any institution of this nature. But we have in the public domain interacted in our constituencies where we work. We have received the reports in our offices of a protection of spiritual abuse by across religions. And in that environment, you have Freedom of Religion South Africa saying, remove spiritual abuse. When in actual reality, this is what we're connected with every day. People are coming and say, I went to my pastor, I went to my reverend, to my bishop, to my father, if I'm as a Catholic that I am, Richard Janji, and I reported issues of domestic violence. And the father, the bishop, chose to just keep quiet and close those issues. Okay? And so when these issues was here, it is an attempt to, even if though it is not exhaustive, because the issue of abuse can be emotional, can be financial, can be physical, can be spiritual. And so you're saying one of those that get to be so current in our lives every day, you are saying do away with it on the basis that you think that it is in some way addressed somewhere by the other acts. In fact, I wanted you to say what you did not say, which is really what is this fear that you have? What harm will this definition of spiritual abuse do if it is in this bill and act later? I've not heard you talking about the harm it would cause, because these are the kind of things, Chair, that we'll be interested in. Because the definitions are not just the definition for the sake of their definition. They are there to assist us to attend to quite a lot of matters, even when we go to court. So, because the fact that it is there as an emphasis, even for me, it would not even ever be a problem. So I thought, Chair, I must just raise those two issues to invite the For South Africa back to convince us. So I want to say on these two issues, I remain unconvinced. I remain unpersuaded about why you want us to do this kind. And therefore, you've got an opportunity to win over one or two members on this. And Richard Judge is willing to be won over. Can you please do that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Honorable Janji, for alerting the Chair about the presence of members of the Committee on Women, Youth and People Living with Disability. We really do appreciate that you are part of these proceedings. As you would be aware, the rules do allow you space if you want to raise questions. You can raise questions because you are members of Parliament. And thank you for your attendance and being part of us. This is a very serious matter that needs all of us to work together. Thank you very much for your presence. And please feel free to participate where you feel that certain issues have not been covered. Honorable Nivot Drachens.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you to 4SA for the presentation. Even though my colleagues have mostly covered me, however, that word, spiritual abuse, they've covered me on that. But I would just like to say, even though you say that there are certain laws that already cover abuse by people in, you know, religious garb, gender-based violence, abuse happens in different churches. And I am from a deaf school, a Catholic deaf school, and I'm aware of abuses that happen there. And, you know, the abuse is everywhere. So if we leave the term spiritual abuse in the term, in the Act, how do we enforce it? Like, so it has to be there to, you know, put emphasis on the fact that abuse does happen in religious circumstances. Gender-based violence is a pandemic. Men, boys as well, women, children are affected by gender-based violence. So I also am in support of what my colleagues have raised also, that can you explain further, you know, or motivate why it should not be in the Act? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Newport Dachens. Honorable Jacqueline Mufokeng.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. Chair, I want to join my colleagues by also saying that, in fact, on Honorable Janji, I want to be also coming to say they need to convince me. Spiritual abuse, it's spiritual abuse, and we have seen it happening. And these are things that we are seeing people will hide behind with harmful practices. And we know that churches are full of women. And all these things are happening all over, and we want to still go on that, even if we are saying that we are dealing with a pandemic. I really need to be convinced, because we're supposed to be getting people like for South Africa coming to say, if this bill is passed, which is going to be passed, implementation is what we are going to be working together on. We have good examples. Honorable Janji spoke about Kwasi Sizabantu. That thing is very dangerous. It's it's hurting. An allegation, you see a woman crying in front of a commission, and we want to come and say spiritual abuse must be removed. Can you tell us how are we going to replace it, and replace it with what? Because there's another case that is in PE of Omotoso. Young women left, actually being called to churches, joined the churches to be in church choirs, and the next thing they were abused. Really, let us not actually hide behind that. We are Christians. And for me, for spiritual abuse not to be in there, I will be feeling that I am actually one that will be feeling bad, because as a Christian, Christians should do the right things, and people must not hide behind religion to do wrong things. I look at your For South Africa is a legal advocacy organization working to protect and promote the rights of religious freedom. Why didn't you also go and make sure that the very same people that practices those harmful practices, you actually deal with them or advise them to do things better? We get information of bishops abusing women, some of them going to the church, to their homes, to say that I'm coming to pray for you. We expect our children to go to Sunday schools, but there are people in the Sunday schools also that actually are doing that. We should really come out very clear. I'm really disappointed. I'm a Christian, and I really don't want to hear this thing actually of spiritual abuse without having anything in a replacement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nomathemba Maseko Jele.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation and also my I only have a comment. I'm not sure whether it's a question or it's a comment, Chair, but it is also on the very same issue of the spiritual abuse. I hear most of the time when we talk about spiritual things that have to do with spiritual. We always talk about churches, talk about what is happening in the churches, the leaders' behavior. I agree fully with that issue. We need to address that issue of the harmful practices that are coming from the space of churches and all that. I agree fully. But I still feel that it is still abuse, whether it's spiritually or it is what, it is still the issue of abuse, that issue that we are talking about. It doesn't matter whether it happens in the houses of prayer or it happens outside, but it's still abuse. But my focus here is that we are only, when we talk about this, we are only focusing on the churches. We don't look at the traditional sangomas. I want to put it like that, if I have to, for lack of better word, or putting it in a manner that maybe it is not derogative to the people. There is an abuse that is happening also in these houses where these people get initiated. And I believe that it is another issue that falls under spiritual also. That issue, you find that when these people are being initiated, some of them have been beaten and all those things. So I'm not sure if we want to deal with this issue, we will deal with it in a narrow focusing on something. I'm not saying I'm coming with a solution, but I'm saying whether it is abuse happening in churches or abuse happening in the houses of the sangomas, it is abuse. It is a spiritual abuse. But in terms of the definition, I will hear how our presenters are going to assist us on that one, because it has to cover even that one. But do we take it on the domestic violence act, or is it staying here on the issue of GBV? Because if we want to also to tunnel it on the domestic, because it happens in the houses. It's a house, it's a place, it's just like a church, if you have to choose the space and define it. I will hear and listen to our presenter's response and all that. But this is one issue that you will have to deal with it, look into it in all angles. Thank you, Chief. It's just a comment.
Thank you very much. And I'm hoping that the Department of Justice is also listening, especially on the issues that you have raised. So that when they come with the responses, I think they should have applied themselves to those issues seriously. Over to you, ma'am. Can you respond to the issues raised?
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, Honourable Committee members, for engaging with me. I really appreciate it. At the outset, I want to say, Honourable Janti, I don't want to give a recommendation off the top of my head. It's something I want to go think about, and also I want to get input from the rest of the 4SA team. But I will definitely be emailing through a recommendation to Mr. Romano, which I trust you will share with the rest of the committee as the committee secretary. I've tried as best to try and capture all the questions asked. If I miss one, please alert me to the fact. Honourable Horn and Honourable Swart, I'm going to combine my answer to your question. So Honourable Horn's question, just to quickly recap, was regarding the balancing of rights and whether or not, you know, that the Violence Amendment Bill won't be a justifiable limitation to religious freedom. Now, as Honourable Committee members would be aware, religious freedom, because it's in the Bill of Rights, can only be limited by Section 36. So if it passes the Section 36 limitation test. And then Honourable Swart asked I should unpack how spiritual abuse is already covered. So Honourable Horn, And answering both these questions, I would submit that because there are existing laws that deal with everything, and I think this would be the gist of my answers for many of the questions that were asked, is that, you know, if I get emotionally abused by my neighbor, and if I get emotionally abused by my pastor, both of those are instances of emotional abuse. So the big concern is that, as we put out in our presentation, is that just because it happens to be dressed in the garb, as one of the committee members so eloquently put, doesn't make it any different. It is still abuse. If, you know, my former partner is refusing to pay maintenance, that is still financial abuse, you know. And if my pastor is exploiting me for money, that's also financial abuse. Again, just because it's dressed in religious garb doesn't make it any different. So when it comes to the balancing of rights that Honorable Horn asked about, I would submit that because there are existing laws that actually address all of these instances of various forms of abuse that can happen, it wouldn't pass the Section 36 limitation test. Furthermore, I would submit that just practically, this committee should want to pass a law that is going to improve the legal landscape of South Africa, and over-regulation of something, you know, like calling emotional abuse spiritual abuse because it happens in a religious setting, or it happens, you know, it's dressed up in the garb of religion, isn't going to change the fact that it's emotional abuse. It's just going to muddy the water. Which brings me to the Honorable Swart's question about the educational role that religious institutions can play, and that civil society can play. I would submit that the CRL Rights Commission is a state institution. It's a Chapter 9 institution, and it's ideally placed, along with religious organizations, to address the issues of gender-based violence, and to also make people aware of what the existing laws are that can help. Furthermore, we did highlight in our presentation, in our written submission to the committee, that we are very glad to see that third parties, for example, can now apply for protection orders, which means that, you know, if, say, I was married to an abusive husband, and my pastor became aware of it, he can actually step in and apply for a protection order on my behalf, which is a wonderful development in the Domestic Violence Act. It was actually something we wrote about and highlighted as a shortcoming in the Domestic Violence Act, the principal act as it is. Yes, and then Honorable Yako, she just didn't have a question. Honorable Jante, you asked about undue pressure, what we would advocate for as a replacement. Well, as I said, we will be submitting recommendations in writing later. But for a start, I would say that undue pressure needs to be defined. Like, what is undue pressure? Currently, it's very subjective. You know, I might be feeling, these questions from the committee are undue pressure. You know, I'm really being put on the spot here. But actually, we need an objective definition for what undue pressure is, so that objectively we can see if it happens in a situation. So that's one of the immediate shortcomings that I can point out. We will give it a think further as an organization and get back to you about maybe what the definition like that can look like. Regarding what harm will the definition of spiritual abuse do? Honorable Jante, something that 4SA has come across recently, well, not recently, since it's been in existence, is the law of unintended consequences. You know, if we define something now, we include something in an act, and at the time it seems fine, but it inadvertently a couple of years down the line, the domino effect of that is consequences that we didn't even foresee at all. So just from the get-go, when, for example, abuse in all its various forms are already illegal, you know, just because we now tag the word spiritual in front of it doesn't actually make a difference. Emotional abuse is emotional abuse. Physical abuse is physical abuse. Financial abuse is financial abuse. Psychological abuse is psychological abuse, irrespective of who does it. Just because of the law of unintended consequences, you don't know what that definition or what the inclusion could cause down the line. But what we can say immediately is that it's not adding anything. In fact, it's just confusing matters more, because everything this thing tries to cover is already covered by other laws, and over legislation isn't going to help anyone. What needs to happen is education through bodies like the CRL Rights Commission, who, for example, just off the top of my head now, are ideally placed to educate pastors as religious leaders and imams as religious leaders and gurus as religious leaders on what domestic violence is, what the law says, what their responsibilities are, you know, in terms of reporting it, and for that message to filter down into the greater society. Then, of course, making sure that the South African Police Service, who work very hard, we all know, but we also all know that there's a problem with, you know, taking domestic violence seriously by some members, are educated on it. If we really, like with the Victim Support Services Bill, which is currently still a problem to social development, if the aim of the government really is to put the victim at the center of the justice system, we need to make sure that laws, firstly, people know what the laws are, so there's an educational responsibility that needs to happen, but all members of society, but, you know, like your average pastor down the road isn't going to know the intricacies of the Domestic Violence Act. It's not his field. But the CRL Rights Commission can educate him on that. And then my local police station around the corner needs to know that if I report an instance of domestic violence or I report an instance of emotional abuse by my pastor or husband or whoever, that they need to take it seriously and what those steps are. So again, spiritual abuse doesn't add anything, could have very much unintended, unforeseen consequences down the road, and in fact, isn't going to solve any problem. It's going to over-regulate and muddy the waters. Having 10 laws that deal with the same thing and make the same thing illegal doesn't help anyone. What you want is one law that's properly implemented. Honorable Nivo Drukin, you adequately said abuse is everywhere. And you asked, how do we enforce spiritual abuse or the prohibition of spiritual abuse? You emphasize that abuse happens in religious settings, and can I motivate why 4SA doesn't want spiritual abuse in the act? Hopefully my answer to Honorable Horn, Honorable Swart, and Honorable Jante has answered that question.
Sorry. We will give you 2 minutes to round up.
Thank you, Chair.
Over time now.
Okay. And then Honorable Mofokeng, I'm very glad you raised the example of Omotoso in the Eastern Cape, because Omotoso is actually standing trial for rape, for sexual trafficking, for emotional abuse, and various other forms of crime. So that just brings home the fact that actually the inclusion of spiritual abuse isn't going to add anything. All of these things that happen are already covered by existing laws. What we need is the education of the public about things that these are illegal and they exist, and the enforcement of those existing laws. Then regarding 4SA's role about educating people that they shouldn't be doing these things, I would submit that we are a civil rights organization, and that it's actually the CRL Rights Commission and mandate. It falls within their ambit to do that. We do what we can, but actually it's within the CRL Rights Commission's mandate to ensure these things. Where we become aware of things, we inform the CRL Rights Commission so they can step in and exercise their powers of the CRL Rights Commission Act. Right, Chair, I hope I have answered everything.
Thank you very much. I must also say to members, let's try and be straight to the point when we ask questions so that we don't exceed the time frames that we have set for ourselves. As we interact with other presenters, let's bear that in mind. We are still going to have an opportunity where we are going to be debating these issues when we deliberate. Let's ensure that our questions are pointed and straight to the point. Thank you very much, ma'am, for the presentation. And I think also it would be important for even for yourselves and even for the department to look at the case law on the undue pressure, because it might, as part of our jurisprudence, it might be much more clearer there. As part of the further representation that you might want to make, to say what does our case law say, how does our case law define undue enrichment. Thank you very much, ma'am, and have a good day. You can continue to listen if you so wish, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So our next presenter is Research ICT Africa.
Thank you very much, Chair. I will be presenting on behalf of the team. May I please be allowed to share my screen?
That will be highly appreciated.
Thank you. I still have the screen disabled.
Can you assist? Can you assist the committee secretariat?
Yes.
Can you assist?
Hello, Chen. Good day, members. I'm there. We've got unstable network, me and Mr. Raman. To an extent that the system has made Ms. Daniela, who was the presenter, a host. So if Ms. Daniela can get us our powers back.
Yes, no, we do have it now. Research ICT Africa.
The host.
Yes. No, we do have the presentations. Research ICT Africa, you have 20 minutes to make your presentation. You can start.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, Chairperson Maganishe and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. We are thankful for this opportunity to engage with you this morning and commend the committee both for its efforts in seeking to improve and enhance the protection for victims and survivors of online gender-based violence, and for your commitment to this participatory drafting process. I am Chennai Chair, a tech and gender policy researcher with World Wide Web Foundation, but today I speak to you as co-coordinator of the Feminist Being Well African Network, and I am presenting alongside the co-authors of our joint submission, Mutondi Mlauzi, gender and law researcher and PhD candidate based at UNISA and Wits University, Samantha Malunga, research associate at the AIDS and Society Research Unit, University of Cape Town, and who are members of Feminist Being Well African, Dr. Andrew Renz, a senior research fellow at Research ICT Africa, who is an attorney, researcher, and policy expert, Tina Power, an associate at ALT Advisory, and Anri van der Spey, a doctoral fellow at Research ICT Africa. We stand before you today as civil society, activists, technologists, policymakers, academics, lawyers, researchers, feminists, concerned citizens, concerned migrants, and generally concerned people. Together, we want to raise the awareness of the evolving nature of domestic violence as a result of the growing prevalence of information and communication technologies, ICTs, in South Africa and beyond. As is evident from our written submission, we seek to make very narrowly tailored points regarding online domestic violence. By way of brief roadmap of what we will be presenting on, we will begin by highlighting the relevant context within which we understand the prevalence of online domestic violence. Thereafter, we will take the committee through some of the broader considerations we think may be of use to the committee as we continue to grapple with the important piece of legislation. We will then tend to specific submissions as we have made and conclude our suggested recommendations to the Domestic Violence Bill. To begin with, by context, Chairperson, as a point of departure, we note the grave concern that domestic violence and in particular gender-based domestic violence impacts on the ability of South African women, children and the gender diverse community from living a meaningful and fulfilling life. The violence is everywhere, in daily commutes, in schools, places of work and in the home. Even when the solution to address the pandemic was to stay at home, not all homes were safe. There was an alarming increased report of domestic violence and an urgent need for women's shelters. When it comes to the digital space, South Africa is one of the leading African countries in the region when it comes to internet access, with over half of the population connected. We actually, in this context, commend digital-based solutions to addressing gender-based violence, such as zero-rated domestic violence codes, code words to signal help for help through social media, and the use of AI-based innovations such as Soul City's Rainbow to provide a support for domestic violence. But one must note that the rural-urban divide persists, and the inequality online, the inequality offline, which manifests online as well, means as more and more people come online, some may not have the necessary digital skills to navigate the online space. We recognize the work towards closing the digital divide in South Africa, but if we do not ensure a safe space online that allows for everyone, in particular those who are often marginalized offline, we risk working towards an internet that works for very few people in the population. As we've placed this context, we also want to note that digital technologies and the internet have been in many instances become yet other tools in which domestic violence, harassment, abuse, misogyny, sexism, racism, homophobia, and transphobia are amplified. The proliferation of online harms or harms facilitated, abated, or aggravated by the internet, social media, and the use of other ICTs is indeed a practical challenge that has grown increasingly prevalent over the last two decades. This slide set indicates some of the figures of the extent to which it is experienced at a regional and global level. However, there is concern of the lack of research that, particularly in South Africa, that helps in understanding the brevity and dearth of these issues in our African region and in South Africa. Globally, it has been recognized that online gender-based violence is a continuum of violence against women. As we have noted in the 2015 resolution on eliminating domestic violence, the UN Human Rights Council recognized that the act of domestic violence is cyberbullying and cyberstalking. CEDAW, the Commission on the Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, actually points out that states need to recognize the empowering use of digital technologies, but at the same time develop mechanisms to combat the use of information and communication technology to perpetrate violence against women and girls. That increasingly so, there is a need that to balance human rights, digital rights, freedom of expression and access to information, for example, while at the same time safeguarding these online spaces. This does require a careful, nuanced approach that provides safeguards without stifling other rights such as freedom of expression. It is in this background we seek to raise awareness of the evolving nature of domestic violence as a result of the growing prevalence of information and communication technologies in South Africa and beyond. In the considerations for the amendment bill, we highlight overarching issues that we urge Parliament to take into account as the bill is being developed. We focus on the governance model that would enable a more meaningful and contextual-based approach, a collaborative multi-stakeholder model. When we take a multi-stakeholder model that is collaborative, it ensures an approach that everyone can play their role in ensuring an online safe space, and even victims and survivors may be able to contribute to practical solutions. We urge the portfolio committee to focus on collecting new and assessing current data to understand the prevalence of online and tech-assisted violence at varying intersectionalities. We encourage that to understand the specificity of harms in the South African context, in particular with gender-diverse groups. To actually disaggregate the current domestic violence data to the extent of the use of technology in aggravation and abating, and also to understand how best to support reporting of such a complex and often considered abstract harm when it comes to victims and survivors. We also strongly urge the portfolio committee to take a broader look at the role of digital and technology intermediaries in supporting or mitigating the impact of domestic violence, recognizing the context of digital inequalities that are specific to South Africa. The issues of online and tech-assisted violence may seem to be in the ambit of the Cyber Crimes Bill of 2017 and the amended Film and Publication Amendment Act. We actually strongly encourage the Portfolio Committee not to just defer tech-assisted violence to these other legislations, but rather adequately and appropriately address amendments to the Domestic Violence Act. Lastly, as digital technologies may be used to file legal actions, as we've seen in the current bill, we strongly encourage that the committee ensures the rights to privacy and principles of data protection are reflected and or properly implemented in the amendments. We strongly urge collaboration with the information regulator to be responsive to privacy and data concerns in the context of domestic violence, specifically gender-based violence. And so now I move on to the specific recommendations that we have towards the bill, which encompass three key issues. And these are ensuring the bill adopts a nuanced and evolving understanding of online domestic violence and domestic violence aided, facilitated, and abated by ICTs. To think about the reporting responsibilities in relation to directions, and also the need for data protection requirements in respect of integrated electronic repository for domestic violence protection orders. So I start off and think in our first point around the definition. We commend the Portfolio Committee for recognizing the need for expanding the definition of harassment. However, we are concerned that the proposed amendments do not go far enough in providing for a digitalized environment. Given the variation in definitions, the evolving nature of online harms, and the rapidly evolving nature of ICTs and datafication, we propose a facilitative definition that takes into account these complexities. We propose that the definition of domestic violence and sexual harassment be expanded to be reflective of violence and harms that occur online. And in this regard, our definition that we propose states as follows. Online domestic violence means acts of domestic violence that are committed, abated, or aggravated in part or fully by the use of information communication technologies such as mobile phones, the internet, social media platforms, and email. We actually also want to reiterate that these harms and the descriptions associated need to be understood within the context of rapidly developing online space and digital technologies. Furthermore, before I hand on over to my colleague, I just want to give more context examples on what exactly these harms mean and drawing from our various regional and global work on violence, on what they actually include. So when we talk about surveillance, we talk about partners and former partners actually observing what you're doing online and then carrying out or building up information to accompany threats, which would then result in malicious intent. When we talk about tracking and monitoring, we're talking about spyware being put on devices and the collection of location of your partner and former partner with the intention of actually being able to say, this is where you are and this is how I see where you are when you think you are safe and away from an abusive partner. When we talk about controlling devices, we actually are reflecting on the extent to which one now has limited control over their own mobile device, over any other connected technology in their house. In one case, a former partner or an abusive partner actually installing apps to make appliances in the home run amok, where one begins to think that they are hearing things when actually it is a partner who has made use of devices to control how one is experiencing their lived reality. When you talk about online harassment, we're talking about persistent abusive language and actions in the online space with the aim to shame, silence, embarrass, and humiliate your former partner as a way of control. When we talk about direct threats in the online space, we literally talk about someone saying, I am going to perform some act of violence and communicating this through technology. And specifically with regards to malicious distribution of identifying information as well as non-consensual images, we're talking about the idea of someone actually accessing a person's cloud in a way that they don't even realize that this is happening, and therefore releasing intimate images that may have been shared during a time of agreement or other audio and sensitive data. This may actually also result in outing of people who may not have come, who may still want to keep their sexual identity to themselves or with selected people. And this may then have that impact on gender and sexual minorities. But we want to reiterate that this list is not exhaustive, and the descriptions associated with them need to be understood within the context of the rapidly developing online space. And with this, I hand over to my colleague, Tina Power, to finish off the presentation.
Maybe before you proceed, I think it would be important if you can also read our cybercrime bill that is before the National Assembly. It will be passed soon. It covers quite a number of issues we have raised on cybercrimes. But I think if you can look at it, maybe you can be in a position to make further representation on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I do think that the presentation that is coming up next does respond to this from Ms. Power, so she will add on to this.
Thank you, Shania.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shania. Good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Committee members. My name is Tina Power. I'm an admitted attorney of the High Court of South Africa and a research and analyst at Alt Advisory. I would like to reiterate the thanks of my fellow presenter for the opportunity to engage with you this morning. Chair, before I continue, we are aware of the cybercrime bill and have been actively monitoring it since its inception. We do, however, think that it is important, and hopefully we will make that clear through our submissions today and through our written submissions, that there are specific safeguards and legal remedies afforded to victims and survivors of online gender-based violence, and we think that the Domestic Violence Act is well suited to cater for that. I will, however, elaborate on this further on through the presentation. Before turning to our final submissions, I would like to emphasize one of the points raised by my fellow presenter tonight in an attempt to just clarify why we recommend an expanded definition in relation to domestic violence and sexual harassment. Essentially, Chairperson and Honourable Members, our reasons are threefold. First, based on our lived experiences of being online, our work, the clients we support, the partner organizations and members of society we have engaged with, coupled with our collective research domestically, regionally, and internationally, it is clear that the insidious assault of one's dignity and bodily integrity through the online harms listed by Ms. Chair is a reality for many, yet victims, survivors, and affected persons are not always certain of the availability of legal resources and remedies. And Chair, to your point, while we appreciate that this bill and other legislation, such as the cybercrime bill, deals with these issues to an extent, we submit that an expanded definition will ensure that victims and survivors of domestic violence online are equipped with the necessary legal tools to respond to these harms and are accordingly recipients of appropriate legal protection. Secondly, Chairperson and Honourable Members, our proposed definition is not dissimilar to current international trends, and we submit that such a definition would be in line with South Africa's commitment under international law. Here we refer the committee first to the Human Rights Council Resolution 32 of 2013, which marked the recognition of the principle that human rights protected offline should also be protected online. As alluded to by Ms. Chair, we further refer the committee to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women and the 2018 report of the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, its causes, consequences, and the report that she raised specifically addressed online violence against women and girls from a human rights perspective. We would like to take the committee briefly through the report and highlight some salient points raised by the Special Rapporteur. She began by noting that online ICT-facilitated forms of violence against women have become increasingly common, particularly with the use of everyday and everywhere social media platforms and other technical applications. She then, referencing the Human Rights Council resolution, notes, and I quote, "Since women's rights are human rights and the prohibition of gender-based violence has been recognized as the principle of international human rights law, women's human rights, as developed through comprehensive regional and international jurisprudence and norms, should be protected online, including through the prohibition of gender-based violence in its ICT-facilitated online forms." She thereafter provides a definition of online sexual violence, which aligns with ours in many respects. The Special Rapporteur made several recommendations to state, which we won't take you through today in the interest of time, but we urge the committee to consider these recommendations of the Special Rapporteur. Ultimately, we bring this report to the attention of the committee to reassure the committee that our proposal is in line with international human rights law and South Africa's international human rights commitments. We do, however, briefly wish to note that victims and survivors of domestic violence, both on and offline, are not exclusively women, and it is our understanding that this extends to gender and sexual minorities as well. Our third point in relation to definitions relates to the current moment that we are in and the need for an appropriate recognition of the response to the rising harms committed and assisted or aggravated by the use of digital technologies. My fellow presenter has captured the context around online domestic violence and has indicated that this problem is not unique to South Africa. We are seeing concerning trends across the region and the continent that illustrate that this is a significant problem. At this critical time, in the context of a global health pandemic, we cannot escape the fact that our lives are increasingly moving online and concerns of the likelihood of online harms occurring are not misplaced. Therefore, we submit that during this law reform process, South Africa is presented with an opportunity to take the lead in Africa in setting the appropriate tone in response to these growing and emerging threats. I would now, time permitting, briefly like to take the committee through our final two submissions. Firstly, we welcome the inclusion of Section 5B as an important provision that empowers courts to require electronic communication service providers to give information to them as to the origin and possibility of deleting or blocking communications. We note that this inclusion largely mirrors the provision of protection from the Harassment Act 17 of 2011, which came into effect in 2013. Helpful as this is, we are of the view that this will not enable South Africa to measure the emerging trends of rapidly changing phenomena, especially with regards to whether tracing, blocking, and deleting communications are effective in combating online domestic violence. As my fellow presenter indicated, and as reflected in our written submission, there are substantial difficulties in relation to the appropriate capturing of data regarding online harm. Our recommendation in relation to this section is therefore very specific. We submit that the electronic communication service providers should report annually on the extent to which they have been able to trace, block, or delete communications. To clarify, this isn't about intermediary liability or placing expectations on service providers to remove content. We submit that the proposed inclusion would simply serve two purposes. One, it would give ongoing empirical indications to the efficacy and efficiency of Section 5B, and two, it would encourage electronic communication service providers to assess their own efforts to comply with the law in a holistic rather than disparate way. Chairperson, honourable members, our final submission is straightforward. We welcome the establishment of an integrated electronic repository.
We have 1 minute.
Thank you, Chair. I will wrap up very quickly. We welcome the inclusion in Section 6A of the Act. We do, however, wish to emphasise that it is right that privacy and the protection of personal information in the context of domestic violence should be treated with heightened care owing to the sensitive nature of information as well as possible harms that may flow from unauthorised disclosure. This could have significant psychosocial consequences for victims and survivors and could, if not managed appropriately, undermine the core tenets of the domestic violence bill. We therefore urge the committee to expand on the role of a fit and proper person referred to in Section 6A and ensure that Section 6A aligns with our legal framework in relation to privacy and data protection rights. Chairperson, honourable members, owing to the prevalence of emerging technologies and the potential for harm, violence and abuse in the digital environment, we urge the committee to ensure that the bill reflects these emerging and developing challenges and enables victims and survivors of domestic violence, both on and offline, to benefit from the maximum protection from domestic abuse that the law can provide. Chairperson, honourable members, we thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You are right on time. I will now note the following members who have raised their hands is Honourable Kubu Dilijanje, Honourable Noma Themba Masego Jele, Honourable Jacqueline Fukeng, Honourable Nivot Krachens. Any other member?
Chair, it's Werner Horn. Will you please note me as well?
Honourable Horn, I can see your hand now. Any other hand? Okay, let's start with Honourable Kubu Dilijanje.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. In line with your directive, I'm going to be very brief so that we don't become all over the place. Thank you for that guidance, Chair. It's a quick one, Chair, and thanks to research ICT Africa, quite comprehensive work and presentation. I think you summed it up when you say we're living online, and COVID has really put us in that space if we did not do that before. It's more of a request, Chair, not for response now, but it's something that they can share with us post this, because I'm very curious about this online domestic violence. Curious in the sense that the practical influence, but I think some of the definition that Chinai indicated are very helpful. And therefore my request, Chair, would be firstly, to ask how prevalent statistically, if you were to give us empirical evidence, is this happening at least in our country, in South Africa? Because I think there must be a basis for us to introduce, create any law. Don't just create a law because there's an opinion, there's an argument being made. If you can just indicate that. And also, secondly, if you've got any further material that would help us understand more this kind of, because I find it to be at least for me, a virgin kind of territory for now, as you can hear my questions, so that you can submit that with the committee for us to enrich ourselves further beyond today's. And lastly, Chair, there seems to be an emphasis from Chennai on the former husband or former boyfriend or whatever. So, and my question is, from where I'm sitting, I thought this would happen even without it being an ex or former, because it goes beyond the fact that this was somebody that you are involved with in some form or the other. If you can just clarify that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mfokeng.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation, Chennai Research ICT team. I really want to appreciate your presentation, especially when you listed the example of the tech-assisted violence, and amongst others that maybe Honorable Janti was asking is about how does domestic violence happen online. I really want to say that with my understanding that is actually something that is happening, because we find that on the malicious distribution of certain pictures of somebody when they were in a relationship before, or even it goes out at hand, we have seen a lot of suicides. And that I will support you that we really need to look at this list. We really need to look at the list very, very carefully, because you are listing, tracking, direct threats, you know, civilians and all that. And those are things that this domestic violence must be able to deal with it. And you said it correctly to say that there's digital inequalities. But I want to ask, on the online report, don't you think that it's going to be an advantage to that woman next door who doesn't have this, that will be able to run to you and you'll be able to register for that person? Because remember, domestic violence can be registered by any other person who wants to help somebody. I think for that, it can be something that is going to be helpful. And I want to say to you that I do subscribe to the Human Rights Council resolution of 2013. That I subscribe to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honorable Nivold Drachens.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you to ICT Africa for your presentation. I want to go to slide number 9. Slide number 9, with regards to the statistics and the numbers, I want to ask, is that South African numbers or is it something else? And then secondly, let's just have a look. Only 7%. or deactivated accounts, and then 1% ignores the perpetrators, and only 8% stopped using online services, and only 17% reported. Now, these low numbers, those who control social media, they're not in South Africa, they're overseas. So previously when I sat in communications, how do you regulate something that is not in South Africa, right? So now I want to know from you, does ICT give any intervention to those social media controllers who are overseas? Do you intervene? How do you intervene when something like this happens to reduce online abuse in South Africa? And then the pictures that you showed on the slides are very good for children. So during lockdown, a deaf mother told me that cyber bullying during online classes were quite prevalent from a very posh school in Claremont. But the teacher then called the parents. You know, sometimes the parents and the children don't know that online bullying exists and what to do when something like that happens. So what would be your intervention there? Do you provide any education in terms of that? And then slide 11, that green block that says definition, expanded definition. I want to know what are examples of the expanded definition. Can you give an example to equip the necessary legislators? So give us an example in terms of that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. Honorable Horn?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I also wanted to just request some clarity from the presenters in respect of the use of the term violence in relation to activities that happens online and virtually. And I want to suggest that obviously in terms of our common law, such activities can only qualify as abusive in nature, and that the answer that it really should be then to rather, as is envisaged, extend the type of behavior for which the protection could be afforded to victims to abusive behavior, and that we must not muddy the waters by trying to amend the really, I would say, straightforward and common sense definition of what constitutes violence. But I would like to get their comments in any event regarding that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? None. Can you respond to the questions raised by honourable members?
Thank you, Chairperson. We have quite a few members of our team who are present on the call with us today, and we will be responding to different questions. I will start off with the question in relation to what practical steps can be taken and specifically how this links to children and what is being done outside of the law reform processes. And it's a very good question, and it's something that we have been considering for a long time, and it's something that a lot of the partner organizations that we work with have been considering. We think, as my co-presenter, Ms. Chair, suggested, digital divides come with a variety of complications, and insufficient digital literacy is one of the key barriers to sort of meaningfully accessing the online world, which can then have quite severe consequences for victims and survivors and children of a variety of forms of harms. So we would suggest that one of the key starting points is to develop educational campaigns, which are already underway. There are organizations in civil society who are already doing a lot of work, particularly with children, to equip them with the necessary digital skills and also to equip parents and caregivers so that they can identify threats and learn about the different consequences of cyberbullying and the different harms that can extend to that. This then sort of, I will then address the second question, which is in relation to being able to use your neighbor's facilities to launch things online, which again speaks to digital literacy. And it is a huge problem in the country. But as we are moving more online, as ICASA is allocating more spectrum and as the Competition Commission is engaging with data prices, it is likely that more and more people will become online. And that will have the indirect effect of people becoming digitally literate as they progress, which we think in turn will have quite positive impacts on people understanding the risks and being able to identify risks and report risks. Without taking too much time, I would like to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Mutondi Malawzi, who will take the next set of questions. Thank you, Chair.
Please note that you have 9 minutes as an organization to respond to all the questions.
Thank you, Chair. We've noted that.
I'll respond to Honourable Nivot Verhoef. And so it's not entirely possible to prevent abuse that happens online where some of that is taking part in another country. So, for example, if some children in one country bully a school child in this country, it's not possible to entirely block that. But it's partially possible, which is why we already have draft 5B in the amendment. In some cases, the service providers will be able to block that. And we've simply recommended that be reported, because this is a very rapidly changing, ongoing situation. And we suggest that this Domestic Violence Act be future-proof, that we get information and that we have the definitions we've suggested ready to look towards the future. Even if we don't have massive evidence of online harms now, we're suggesting the legislation should be future-proof. And in particular, that it affords people protection orders where they're possible. So where it's possible to order a service provider to block content. And most of the domestic online issues are not going to be taking place from overseas. So although that's a bigger problem for cybercrime generally, the distinction between the Cybercrime Act and the Domestic Violence Act is Domestic Violence Act gives protection orders. It gives agency to people who are victims, and they can get a protection order, and they're not reliant on the police investigating and the prosecutor prosecuting. They've got agency. They can do something. And so I'll just respond briefly on the definitions and then hand over to my colleague. So as we understand the current Domestic Violence Act and its amendment, both of these have a long list of things which are not physical violence, but which are defined as violence. Our suggestion is that our additional definitions could fit into either directly into the definition of violence. So, for example, the malicious sharing of these intimate images. The definition of intimate images we actually took more or less directly from the cybercrimes bill. They could nest in one of the subcategories. So, for example, the malicious sharing of images could also be regarded as sexual violence, or it could just be directly in the definition of violence, the scheme of the act. If Honorable Horn thinks that the master category shouldn't be violence, or but it should rather be abuse, then I think that's a debate within the committee. But we think that our definitions should fit within whatever master category is finally included in the Domestic Violence Act. Thank you for the opportunity to respond to your questions.
Thank you so much, Andrew. And noting the time that we've been told that it was quite limited, I do want to respond quickly to what was pointed out by Honorable Yanti, that I was using the terms former and present, but that is more kind of in context and example, but that does not mean that is exactly what happens in those situations. So my apologies if I might have led the committee astray. But I also want to come back to the point around I commend the committee for wanting to have the statistics and numbers in trying to understand the extent of online gender-based domestic violence. But I want to come back to the understanding that the report of domestic violence in context is a difficult issue because of the kind of systems that we have in place. This then impacts on the kind of evidence that we have to trying to understand the extent of domestic violence in general that we've existed with for a very long time, and online domestic violence. And then this comes to the point of in slide 9, the study that has been quoted was actually commissioned as a very urban high-level study trying to understand the levels of indicativeness of online gender-based violence. And although a statistical methodology was taken in getting the numbers, what was realized in this research, which we will share with the committee as well, was that the nuance of the issues, which also raises the question of people being actually able to identify these issues, made it difficult for people to actually tick a form to say, yes, I've experienced it. But when you engage in qualitative research and actually then decide to unpack what is your experience online, these are when these issues do come up. And this is the point that we are putting forward to the portfolio committee, that as collection is being done on domestic violence, there is an opportunity for there to be disaggregated data at the extent to which, as one is experiencing this domestic violence, what extent was TIC part of this system? Because if we have the kind of data disaggregated at those different intersectionalities that we mentioned of gender, race, or sexuality, we would then be able to say this is the extent of the challenge that's involved. And we also would then strongly encourage for there to be more investment in actually working with civil society, as we've pointed out in our governance model, and institutions such as Research ICT Africa, in being able to document this work, and also working with existent organizations on domestic violence, because the sensitivity of this issue means that it cannot just be about numbers, but really about taking a preemptive role of how do we ensure that our authorities are trained well enough to understand that as this abuse or violence has happened, this is the platform in which it took place, and it is not just an abstract harm that we then say because it happened on a particular platform, it doesn't count. So that is the point that we're trying to advocate for in our submission. And we look forward to presenting more material that the committee can engage with and also work with us in this trying to understand of how do we ensure that South Africa becomes a lead in ensuring online tech-assisted violence is included within the ambit of domestic violence. And with that, I conclude and thank you very much for your time and listening to our submissions. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Research ICT Africa. You were within your time. You are still left with 2 minutes. Thank you very much for respecting the time and for the content you've given us. All the submissions will be taken into consideration when we deliberate on the bill. We will now invite Rape Crisis.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, committee members, and members from the public who are attending. I just want to see if I have permission to share my screen. Doesn't seem that way. Maybe the hosts can just give me permission for sharing. Are the hosts able to give me permission to share my screen?
Chairperson, I'm trying to get the name of the person who wants to present. As they're busy doing that, you can start with your introductions. I think the committee secretariat will be working with your organization to upload and flight the slides.
Thank you, Chairperson. I did send my presentation to the secretary. We're doing presentations on the Criminal Matters Amendment and Criminal Matters and Related Matters Amendment Bill. This is a joint submission by Rape Crisis, Lawyers for Human Rights, and Judges Matters Campaign. I'm joined by a colleague from Lawyers for Human Rights who is in the gallery. So she's available if there are any questions. So firstly, the Constitution in Section 34 provides that everyone has a right to have any dispute be resolved by the application of the law, and for this to be decided in a fair public hearing before a court where another independent and impartial tribunal or forum. And the Criminal Procedure Act of 1977 then aims to set out the criminal justice procedures to be followed in order to give effect to Section 34 of the Constitution. The purpose of the amendment bill before the committee today, or of one of the bills, is threefold. Firstly, it's to make it more difficult for persons accused of crime involving sexual and gender-based violence and femicide to get bail. Secondly,
my apology, Chair. Can we just get an indication, Chair? Well, I would like to follow the presentation, and it's quite difficult. Okay, it comes now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can you proceed, Ms. Watson?
Firstly, the purpose of this amendment bill is to make it more difficult for persons accused of crimes involving sexual and gender-based violence and femicide to get bail. Secondly, to make it more difficult for such persons to get parole. And thirdly, to make minimum sentences for crimes involving sexual and gender-based violence and femicide harsher than what they are now. And while we do not have concerns with the first two statements regarding the purpose, we do have a serious question to ask about the minimum sentencing and the increasing of minimum sentences. And the central question really is, will the proposed amendments contribute meaningfully that survivors have better access to justice, and does it contribute meaningfully to the purpose of of this bill and its overarching goal of increasing access to justice. And I think that is a question to ask of all of the bills in question, although we are dealing with this bill exclusively. And our submission is that increasing already high minimum sentences won't contribute meaningfully to access to justice for the greatest possible number of sexual and gender-based violence and femicide survivors and their loved ones. And in fact, these proposed amendments might just be pieces of feel-good amendments to contribute to us having a sense of wellness if we think about harsh sentences. But we argue that this actually does not improve survivors' access to justice, and it doesn't improve the general public and communities' access to justice, and therefore it doesn't fit with the purpose of the bill. So why shouldn't we increase minimum sentences? So there's no credible evidence that harsher minimum sentences deter crimes, including sexual offences. And then very shockingly, minimum sentences only have an impact on less than 9% of reported matters. So only cases where a guilty verdict is reached are cases where minimum sentencing provisions will have an impact. And the most comprehensive and recent study on this was done by the South African Medical Research Council. They looked at 4,000 reported cases at police stations. And of those, only 8.6% had a guilty verdict. So minimum sentencing legislation would only apply to 8.6% of those 4,000 cases. And that means that more 91.4% of survivors will not be affected by the minimum sentencing legislation. And the minimum sentencing legislation will have no positive impact on them or give them an increased sense of justice. So in order to truly ensure that the maximum number of victims of sexual and gender-based violence and femicide and their loved ones have access to justice, the focus should be on what happens before conviction and not after. So the current situation, and this might be, hopefully it is a shocking picture, is that over the past 6 years, so I had a look at the official NPA annual reports from 2014-2015 financial year to the 2019-2020 financial year, showed that the number of cases finalized with a verdict, that's the column second from the left, have decreased quite severely over the past 6 years by almost 2,000 cases. So cases finalized with a verdict is defined by the NPA as cases which has a verdict of any kind. So a guilty verdict, a not guilty verdict, an acquittal, whatever. So the number of cases has actually decreased significantly over the past 6 years. If you then look to the far right column, you'll see that the number of actual convictions has decreased by 1,000 over the past 6 years. And those numbers represent people who have been raped, people who have been sexually assaulted. And the number of those people who receive justice, we can see yearly getting less and less. However, the conviction rate, which is often the number that is printed on the billboards, has increased. But that is merely because less and less cases were prosecuted. So the conviction rate is calculated by taking the number of convictions, dividing it by the number of cases finalized with a verdict, and then multiplying it by 100. And then you will get the conviction rate. So what this slide shows us is that the number of cases finalized with a verdict has been decreasing almost yearly, with the shocking number. The number of actual convictions has decreased almost yearly. So fewer and fewer survivors have a sense of justice, and fewer criminals are being prosecuted. And then I just included how the conviction rate is calculated. And I think this picture is quite dire. I don't think it's the first time that the committee sees this. I know that it has been discussed in previous meetings, but I think it specifically bears importance when we look at the current amendments. And if we think about minimum sentencing, will minimum sentencing really have an impact that we think it would if we look at the current position? So our submission is that we should actually, as a country, focus on increasing the number of convictions. And the reason why is because this will provide more survivors of SGVVF and their families a sense of justice. But also, it is a greater deterrent to crime if there is a greater chance that the crime will be prosecuted. Because that then actually sends a message to criminals that there is a chance that you will have to account in court for your crime. So increasing the number of convictions and increasing the number of prosecutions really will further demonstrate our commitment to a victim-centric criminal justice system, and it will actually contribute to deterring crime. And then the question, obviously, is how do we do that? The first thing that must be done is focusing on the attrition in the criminal justice system. And attrition happens at various stages. It happens at the police station when the charge officer deters the victim from opening a case. It happens when accused persons can't be traced or can't be found. It happens when the prosecution decides that there is no reasonable prospect for a guilty conviction. And it happens when witnesses later withdraw. So there are many points of attrition, and we're very aware of that. But we have to focus on that if we want to see increased convictions. And then we also have to focus on increased prosecutions. So how do we get more prosecutions? How do we achieve that? The prosecution of sexual offences takes place within a framework of legislation and directives. And firstly, and this has been discussed in this committee before, prosecutors are measured on their conviction rates. So prosecutors aren't measured on the number of convictions that they achieved or on the number of cases that they prosecute, but on what is their conviction rates. And then secondly, prosecutors may only prosecute matters where there's a reasonable prospect of a successful guilty verdict or conviction. So if we want to achieve more prosecutions, we must address both of those things. We must set different performance measurement indicators for prosecutors, but we must also ensure that more cases can reasonably result in conviction. We must achieve stronger cases. We must achieve cases that prosecutors can take forward and prosecute. And we recommend that that one of the ways to do this is to establish specialized forensic units across the country. Sexual offences are notoriously difficult to prosecute. I don't have to tell the committee that. We know that, we hear that from the NPA often, But it has been shown that cases where the victim accessed such a unit, a specialized forensic unit, had a better chance of convictions than cases that just went through the general criminal justice system. So specialized forensic units must be established and must be accessible to all victims of sexual offenses, because that is one of the best ways to ensure that the sexual offenses cases that are reported can be prosecuted and will result in a reasonable prospect of a successful conviction, and then obviously making sure that more survivors have a sense of justice and have access to justice, which will also restore the faith in the criminal justice system that communities so often lack. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Indeed, this presentation, we will continue to use it even beyond these public hearings as part of our oversight over the NPA. And I think generally the public hearings is not only about the bills, but it's also how to strengthen oversight over the criminal justice system to ensure that there is effective implementation of the bill or of the acts once they are approved. So we are very grateful to the presentation and the issues that we have raised. Honorable members, I have noted the following members who would ask questions: Honorable Mufokeng, Honorable Jele, Honorable Horn, Honorable Janji, Honorable Nivod Prachens. Those are the members that have indicated that they want to ask questions. Let's start with Honorable Mufokeng.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation from Rape Crisis. I just want to ask a question that you are saying that you advocate for harsher sentences, which one agrees. But I didn't hear you talking about parole, whether once people are maybe on Schedule 5 or 6, what are you saying about parole? And then I agree with you on the issue of the established specialized forensic unit, because most of the cases failed because of if you don't have any forensic people helping in that. But I also want to check on the issue of the rape kits that are available. Are you happy with them as they are in the police stations? And what is it that you say that there will be a better option? Because I know the process, but are you happy with the rape kits that are available at the moment? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mufokeng, Honorable Noma Temba, Masego Jaili.
Thank you, Chair. And also thank you to the presenter, the Rape Crisis. I only have, in fact, I agree with you, Chair, this presentation assists us more on the issues also of implementation after the whole after we have passed the bill this year. My question is just that, Chairperson, I just want to find out, I hear the presenter says they would love to have have it difficult to want to get bail and also get parole. Do you have any suggestions maybe that you can share with us? Maybe I didn't get that. But do you have any suggestion as to how difficult do you think that can be done? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, and I agree with you. This is obviously helpful to the committee in reminding us of the bigger picture in respect of the way we deal as a country with sexual violence specifically. I just want to maybe get a comment from Rape Crisis as to whether they would agree that the proposed legislative amendment they ultimately included in their presentation talking to specialized forensic units, whether they are of the view that it would be something that we must consider including in the trio of bills we're dealing with now, and whether the setting up of such specialized forensic units are really something that is a policy decision that must be driven on a policy level with the Minister of Police and or the broader security cluster. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janke.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to Rape Crisis lawyers for human rights and Judges Matter, because there's a nice caucus there of those three organizations. Thank you, and you can see the presentation. Chair, mine is only a comment, because I think what we're hearing here, Rape Crisis and team are saying, and they've put that issue of saying to us, they don't really think that harsher sentences is what we need, if I get them correctly. They make that point very clear. And they give even stats in relation to those things. The 9% impact, the poor guilt verdict, which is 8%. And so I think they seem to be saying we need to be, yes, let's do the law, but I think there's something that we need to do beyond the law. It's the issue that happens before and not necessarily on the aftermath. And with that, Chair, it reminds, because the slide they showed of a decline in convictions or prosecutions, when you remember in February, in a session you convened with this entire team of the portfolio committee, there were many shocks in that meeting. One of the shocks was the decline in the prosecution. In February 2020, this before the COVID. And so we had a sense about this ourselves. I really want to welcome, as you say, Chair, and I know they are going to be with us post to this, because we had a Justice Department 2 weeks ago. You know, we're not happy with the kind of performance of that. And yesterday we're talking about the functionality of the justice system. I think this presentation speaks to that issue, that you don't have one magic wand to deal with this issue of GBV or domestic violence. It is a whole of society kind of an approach. And I'm more interested, in addition to the forensic unit, but I'm more interested on the last point they raised, Chair, which is our task. Was they spoke of the nature, you've always raised this issue, the nature of the performance target, the quality, the impact of these performance targets. And I think that's homework for us into the future. And so I'm really happy with this. If there are one or two things that we can put in the act, but it speaks to the leadership role, both in the administration at the political level, in the oversight role of this committee, as well as the social compact with such organizations as Rape Crisis. But that's how you're going to defeat this pandemic. It's not just a law that you can pass and then I don't want to repeat what I said yesterday, that you have a law, you have a conviction, most same thing happens. You have a woman raped, you have a woman murdered, you have a woman bent, you have a woman dumped. Similar modus operandi by all of these kind of men. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nivo Trachens.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you to Rape Crisis for that presentation. And so I see the numbers that you have given us today, 355 out of 855,900 and 23, I don't know if the figures are correct, of the cases that had the opportunity to go to court, but don't go through the court process. And a lot of people often say, I want to have my day in court. I want to see my time in court. So the victim's opportunity to speak out in court is not given. They don't receive that because the prosecutor takes that decision that, a conviction, not going to get a conviction, not going to get a win. So it's the prosecutors who are denying the victim that opportunity to have their day in court. And it's the prosecutors who are the obstacle. And so what do we do with that? What do we do after that? Because the victim remains the victim. They remain with the suffering. The perpetrator can view this and say, well, I can just continue with my crimes because these kind of cases will never see a courtroom. And then the number of abusers just keeps increasing, and the number of victims also keeps increasing. And that is the pandemic. That's the situation that we are in. So what happens after that kind of situation? So I'd like to, you know, give my congratulations to the TCC process. I did visit the Thuthuzela Care Center myself, but we don't have enough of these kind of centers. Every police station does not have a TCC attached to it. Yes, there are family services there. But, you know, in these kind of situations where a TCC is not attached, a police officer can give, you know, make that decision that, you know, this case is not worth the reporting. So I would think that if a victim reports a case, they should directly go to the TCC center where all the services are there, evidence can be collected, et cetera, and then the case can go through. And the NPA is in the Thuthuzela Care Center. You know, so instead of the police, you know, maybe that police member is tired that day and they're just like, oh, you know, just a domestic fight, you and your husband, just you can go home, you'll sort it out. But so if a person comes to the police station and then their case gets dropped, you know, is there a record of that? Perhaps there are a number of case numbers that are, you know, that have not been investigated or taken further that we don't know about because the case just gets dropped. And then in terms of withdrawal of a case, if there's evidence there, everything that is necessary for the case to go through, but because of family pressure or any other kind of pressure, the victim then decides to withdraw the case. Is there, in that case, is there any kind of measure that the case can continue despite the victim's withdrawal? There has to be a way, perhaps an audiovisual court hearing. Is, you know, is that something that can be considered in your view? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Glynis Breitenbach.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning to everybody. I just want to make a comment as a result of the input of Honourable Niva Drachen. Generally, prosecutors are very sensitive to the situation surrounding particularly gender-based violence. And if they don't place a case on the roll because they don't believe it will be, there's no prospect of a successful prosecution, they consider very carefully the impact, both emotionally and psychologically, on all the players in that scenario, including more particularly the complainant. But a court case, particularly a court case surrounding gender-based violence, is particularly harrowing for the victim. The complainant is really put through the grinder in a gender-based violence case, and more particularly in a rape case. So the court experience is deeply unpleasant.
despite all the technological advances, it's still deeply unpleasant. You have to discuss the most intimate of details. You have to submit to very, very rigorous, often very, very rude cross-examination. And so it's not a pleasant experience. If there is no prospect of a successful prosecution, it would be seriously wrong for a prosecutor to place the matter on the roll, allow the complainant to be put through that deeply unpleasant experience when they know from the outset they can't win. There are other methods of dealing with the matter. There are services available to the complainant to try and deal with the fallout, both of the case not being placed on the roll and of the results of the assault or rape complained of. But it would be very irresponsible of a prosecutor to put a matter on the roll simply to give the complainant her day in court with the full knowledge that the prosecution could not be successful. So just that to consider. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And we need also to consider the whole value chain, how the matter was investigated by the investigating officers up to the level where the prosecutors must make a decision whether to prosecute or not to prosecute. So I think what this calls upon on all of us is to ensure that we improve the entire criminal justice system. Over to you, Rape Crisis.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, members, for your very engaging questions. I think I'll start with Honourable Breitenbach's question and then move backwards. So, we are obviously very sensitive and aware that we and that the prosecution does not want to put complainants through that harrowing process if there is no prospect of success. And I think that the legislative framework and the directives are very clear that prosecutors may only prosecute cases where there is that prospect. So our quest really is how do we make sure that there are more cases that have a reasonable prospect of success? And that's why we proposed that more forensic units be established across the country. And now I'll get to Honourable Niva Jachin's questions and comments, which really illustrates that it is often a much better outcome for victims who choose to first report to a TCC and then receive that level of support, and only at a later stage the police is called in for the charges. And I think there's a reason why this is a best practice model internationally. Our concern is that there are only 55 such centres across the country. There isn't one in every corner of every province of the country. And it might be, like Honourable Horn mentioned, it might be a policy decision, but I think that there that the Department of Justice and the NPA has time and time again really illustrated their commitment to establishing specialised forensic units. And I think it really is about how do we go about creatively to make sure that more survivors have access to that level of support, that more survivors have access to that level of having the evidence collected in a responsible and sensitive manner, and making sure that there are more cases presented to the NPA that have a reasonable prospect of success. And I think that that it often is about the value chain of the criminal justice system. But how do we make each part stronger? And the reason why we raised this at this point in the submission process of these three bills is that we have to be extremely careful as a country not to be lulled into a false sense of safety by having our lawmakers and our Department of Justice and our government tell us that we have these wonderful laws, that we have stricter and stricter minimum sentences. But when we do the math, we find out that that actually has very little impact on what happens to most survivors in sexual offences matters. And I think that, I hope that answers Honourable Horne's question. The policy issue really is about how do we think creatively to establish more specialised forensic units so that every survivor has access. But I think the role of this committee is to really ensure that the accountability is practiced, and that the Department of Justice and all of the various role players are held accountable for making those policy decisions. And I think that's the same argument for the performance targets of the prosecutors. It's a conversation that has been had in this committee many times, but has the changes been made? And I think you'll find the answer is no. So really, how does this committee exercise its oversight role? Whether or not it's a policy decision or a legislative decision, I don't think we can legislate specialised forensic units at this moment. But how does the Department of Justice and the NPA do their day-to-day work? And how does that ultimately protect victims and survivors of sexual offences and gender-based violence and femicide? I think I answered Honourable Janchi's comments with that as well. I want to just comment on last point raised by Honourable Nuva Drachen, which is about if a complainant withdraws from a criminal matter at some point, can the matter go forward without them? And that depends on the other evidence available. If there's enough evidence available to still have the case prospect that the case will result in a successful conviction, then the case can go forward. But often that complainant is the only witness for the state. Often the prospect isn't there anymore. I'm going to give over to my colleague, Sonia Bornman from Lawyers for Human Rights, to address the issues of bail and parole and the rape kits raised by Honourable Mofokeng and Honourable Jele.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm just briefly going to address those questions as Ms. Boerenstein has indicated. So when it comes to the issues of parole and bail, as provided for in this draft bill, we do not have any difficulty with these provisions that will essentially make it more difficult for alleged perpetrators of these kinds of crimes involving gender-based violence, sexual violence, and femicide, both to get parole and to get bail. We are comfortable that in the current climate, making it harder to get parole, making it harder to get bail for these alleged perpetrators is appropriate and suitable. Our concern, as Ms. Boerenstein has pointed out, is with the question of minimum sentencing, because our problem is not with sentencing in South Africa. We already have fairly harsh minimum sentences in place. Our problem is with the investigation, the building of a strong docket, and the successful prosecution of these crimes. And this is, as Honourable Breitenbach has pointed out, if a prosecutor does not have a strong docket in front of them, then it becomes increasingly difficult to prosecute a case. And that is where we feel the energy and the emphasis needs to be. On the question of rape kits, unfortunately, we find very often that there are not enough rape kits where rape kits need to be. And another issue of concern is the chain of evidence. So what happens to those rape kits, how they are transported, do they get to where they need to be, and how long does it take to process those rape kits? And we think that this contributes then also ultimately to the strength of a docket and whether a case has reasonable prospects of success for prosecution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is that all on your
That's all from us, Honourable Chair. I think we really also got the message about the time. So I see we made it in time. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, and you also said everything you wanted to say. You have not missed anything.
Thank you. I think we are covered. We also did start 2 minutes early because the previous presenters finished a bit early. So we definitely had our time. Thank you very much. And thank you to the committee for asking such pointed questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now we will invite South African Institute for Advanced Constitutional, Public Human Rights and International Law. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you very much, sir. I am Dr. Ms. Baru. I'm the head of the Sexual and Gender-Based Violence Unit at SIFAC with our very long name that you just read out. We're a research center connected with the University of Johannesburg. It will be both myself and one of our researchers, Ms. Ropafatso Maphosa, that will be making submissions. If I may ask if I can also share my screen throughout our presentation, it will, because Ms. Maphosa will also be using the same presentation. Is that possible?
That will be appreciated.
Okay, thank you. I see I'm disabled to do screen sharing.
Can the committee secretariat assist? But in the meantime, you can start with your introductions.
Okay. Firstly, I would just like to thank the entire drafting committee, whoever has been paying attention to amending our gender-based violence legislation. For me, for us at SIFAC, it is definitely a show of the seriousness with which our government is viewing gender-based violence. So that is absolutely welcomed by us. We are encouraged by this. And I just want to start with that. Let me just see. I see I have been made. Let me just see. I can't see if I... It seems like my sharing is not working for some reason. I'm not sure. Can I just please, if you can just give me a couple of seconds to try and see if I can do so. Okay. It seems like it's not working.
Maybe what we can do, I don't take note of the fact that we have been sitting here for some time and okay. Some members would want to have comfort break. Can we have comfort break until 11:25? Hopefully, by that time, everything would be fine on your side and the committee secretariat would assist you. So it's a 3 minutes break, 2 minutes, in fact, so that we can just stretch our legs. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd be very happy with that.
Thank you, Chair.
Just take care of those dogs in the meantime for a 2 minutes.
I apologize. Did you hear them?
Leave the dogs alone.
It's okay.
Wonderful. So you can see my first slide there, parliamentary submission.
Yes, that's very clear, Doc.
Okay. I can also share it with you afterwards if you need if I can.
You can meanwhile send it so that we can just quickly send it to members as well, those who would want to have it. You can just quickly send it to Mr. Rahman, then we'll share it with the members just now while we're having a break. We're taking a break. Thanks, man. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We will be, in our submission, we will be talking about all three of the bills, only certain points that we want to raise in terms of suggested amendments that will be made to the pieces of legislation that these bills relate to. Firstly, I will be making a presentation on the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill, as well as the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Act. And then Ropafatso Maposa will be making a presentation on the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. So the first point that on the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill that we want to speak about are the additional and amended definitions. So there are certain ones that we welcome in general. One I'm going to spend a little bit of time on. Firstly, controlling behavior, coercive behavior, disability, elder abuse, harm, sexual harassment. All these additional and amended definitions are very warmly welcomed, and we deeply encourage you to keep it in the or to keep the suggested amendments in the Domestic Violence Act. Then I would like to say something about spiritual abuse. And the first, I wanted to say something, but then I realized I will have my time now. So I thought, let me say something a little bit more. In our written submission, we said very little about spiritual abuse, particularly because we just assumed that everyone would be on the same page, that that is something that is extremely important to be included under domestic violence. What I didn't hear, maybe I missed it, but most of the people that were speaking, honourable members as well as freedom of religion, were focusing on the type of domestic violence that takes place within an institution, whether it is a church, a synagogue, whatever type of religious institution there may be. But please let us not forget we are talking about domestic violence. So this is really, for me, my interpretation, spiritual abuse within the domestic sphere, in the home environment. And it is whether you can interpret spiritual abuse to form part of emotional abuse, form part of psychological abuse, even economic abuse. It is of extreme importance to include and to include spiritual abuse under domestic violence. It must be part of the new legislation. So I want to plead with parliamentarians who are our legislature that is busy drafting these legislation, please keep it in. You must place special emphasis on it in addition to the other forms of domestic violence that there is. So even though I didn't add it very specifically or place specific focus on it, I agree with each and every one of you that gave freedom of religion a little bit of a hard time in criticizing them for wanting to take it out. What we do find problematic with the additional and amended definitions is that the suggestion is made to remove stalking from the list of definitions. We do feel that stalking must stay part of domestic violence, that it must not be removed, but please to keep it in the Domestic Violence Act eventually. Then I want to move forward to the public reporting duty. In general, this is welcomed that the public now has a reporting duty. I'll come to the issues that we also have with it. What we want to suggest also is that women are added as a vulnerable group, specifically because the reality is that women and children are already included as a vulnerable group of persons, but that women are also included. The reason for this is to make it in line with the suggested amendment in the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act Amendment Bill, particularly because this will complement.
In this, the former amendment bill, you include women as vulnerable persons, but in the domestic violence amendment bill, women aren't included as a vulnerable group. What we are concerned about, and we also don't pay enough attention to it in our written submission, is that it might open up certain issues that's already existing with the reporting of sexual and gender-based violence as well as domestic violence, is that very often our South African police services response is not as it is supposed to be, as it would be ideal, in as much as believing a victim, a primary victim, to reach out to the South African police service. Now there is an additional duty that is placed on the public to report. So this might complicate matters and reinforce certain societal beliefs around domestic violence. Can you all still hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Point to stay with our points that we are making on the South African Police Service, the responsibility of our SAPS. In general, it is welcomed, specifically around the disciplinary action, which is already in the existing Domestic Violence Act, that there are certain disciplinary action that can be taken. What we are concerned about is the implementation thereof. So there's this duty that's placed on the South African Police Service and also to take disciplinary action against members of the South African Police Service that are not complying with their duties. So we would encourage the proper implementation hereof. So very importantly here is that what is existing in our legislation already in the Domestic Violence Act, that this is reinforced, that it must, the implementation must be improved upon. And then what we would, our suggestion is that, the Commission for Gender Equality, for example, as an independent chapter 9 institution of our constitution, that they are given a type of oversight role so that the SAPS is also held accountable from that point of view. Then also, and this is throughout every single one of our submissions that we make, is that it's extremely important that there must be education. There must be of everyone, all the role players, so society at large. I will come to that also again, back to that. But I think especially with our South African Police Service, there must be more training, especially in sensitivity to the type of violence that we are dealing with here, gender-based violence, domestic violence, sexual violence. So this will also be very much a training, an awareness, and an education role that can be played by civil society. Someone has mentioned this earlier, the role of civil society can also be accentuated a little bit more. So that is what I wanted to say on the Domestic Violence Amendment Bill. Next, I want to move to the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill. And there are three things that I want to highlight. The first of which is the use of intermediaries in non-criminal proceedings. The second is the amendment of bail conditions, and then flowing from that, minimum sentencing in respect of the offence of rape. So starting with the use of intermediaries in non-criminal proceedings, the suggested amendment is that this is left to the discretion of the courts when it comes to specified groups. And the specified groups are a witness under the biological or mental age of 18 who suffers from physical, psychological, mental, or emotional conditions, or an elderly person. And this discretion is given to the court when the court thinks, it appears to the court that the witness will be exposed to undue psychological, mental, or emotional stress, trauma, or suffering. Now, our concern here
is that this is going to lead to inconsistent application. There is already a constitutional court judgment, Director of Public Prosecutions, Transvaal versus Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. That is, of course, quite old because we still speak about Transvaal here, but in any event, where the court also, this was challenged before the Constitutional Court, that there could be inconsistent application. Our submission is that, especially when we come to children, but in fact, all these vulnerable groups that are mentioned here, not only children biological or mental age of 18 years and below, persons who suffer from physical, psychological, mental, emotional conditions, and elderly persons, all these groups are vulnerable. So it's very difficult for us to imagine a situation when there won't be undue psychological, mental, or emotional stress, trauma, or suffering when it comes to a court environment. So, and we also have a problem. We have a concern with this being a discretion of the court. Because, look, it's a reality. Judges are, they sign an oath that they are magistrates, the court, that they must be objective, that they mustn't be influenced by outside factors. But the reality is judges are humans, magistrates are humans. Therefore, the best interest of the child would, in our understanding, make it compulsory in any proceedings, whether it's criminal, whether it's non-criminal, to make it compulsory to appoint an intermediary. This shouldn't be something that is left to the discretion of a judge or a magistrate. So this is our submission on intermediaries. Then the amendment of bail conditions. So if I can just ask you, if I can interrupt myself, how are we looking for time?
You are left with 5 minutes.
Oh, I will quickly just sum this up so that I can hand over to my colleague. We also, with the bail conditions as well as the minimum sentencing, we have certain constitutional concerns, especially around bail conditions. There's a very difficult balance that must be struck between a victim's safety and the accused's right to bail in terms of the Constitution. Then minimum sentencing, I have to also agree with the previous presenter that there are no real proof that there will be guarantees of rehabilitation, protection of victims, and the reduction of crime. I now hand over to my colleague, Ropafatso Maphosa, who will be dealing with the Criminal Law, Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. Thank you.
Before she proceeds, I made a mistake. You are supposed to finish at 11:45. It's now 11:37, which means you have 7 minutes.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Fine. Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone, colleagues, fellow presenters, and members of the committee. I would like to express our appreciation once again for the opportunity to make verbal submissions on the Gender-Based Violence Bills. As noted by Ms. Fine, I will be focusing on the Criminal Law Amendment Act Amendment Bill. While there are many notable amendments proposed in this bill, I would like to highlight SIFAC submissions in relation to the proposed amendments of the National Register of Sex Offenders. Firstly, SIFAC welcomes the inclusion of females under the age of 25 years in the identified group of vulnerable persons. We believe it is important to acknowledge that women in South Africa are considerably more likely than men to experience violence in and outside of the home. Murder, which is the most lethal expression of violence, is most frequently experienced by women in this age group. Therefore, it is imperative for legislation to expressly recognize women as a vulnerable group in order to effectively monitor state efforts to respond to, prevent, and eliminate all forms of violence against women. However, we note with concern that the recognition of these women as a vulnerable group is not consistently applied throughout the proposed provisions, and this has also been highlighted by my colleague. For instance, in our recent submissions, we highlighted Clause 7, Subsection A of this amendment bill, which seeks to include in the register the particulars of persons convicted or alleged to have committed any sexual offense against a child or a person who is mentally disabled. While females under the age of 25 years are identified as a vulnerable group, the details of their perpetrators will be excluded from the register. because this particular provision only applies to children or persons who are mentally disabled. Therefore, this provision is contrary to the objective of protecting persons who are vulnerable against sexual offenders. The second problematic provision in the amendment bill is the provision that seeks to make the particulars of persons who have been convicted of sexual offenses publicly available. This provision is similar to the American federal law, which is known as Megan's Law. This law in America provides for the release of information concerning a sexual offender when it is necessary to protect the public. To this end, websites have been created and made available for public viewing. However, the U.S. has faced great obstacles in the implementation and maintenance of such registers. As a result, the information obtained from the websites is not always accurate. We are concerned that South Africa will find itself in a similar predicament, especially since there are already challenges with the implementation of the National Register in its current form. While we understand the objective of this provision, that is to protect vulnerable persons, it is also important to consider the constitutionality of such a provision. Should it be passed into law, we are concerned that this provision is likely to face constitutional challenges on the grounds that it violates the rights of privacy, equality, and dignity of the registrants. These rights can indeed be limited under Section 36 if it is reasonable and justifiable to do so in an open and democratic society based on the values of human dignity, freedom, and equality. Ultimately, the rights of the registrants need to be weighed against the public's right to information and to freedom and security of the person in terms of Section 36. The following factors must be considered in determining whether the limitation of the listed person's rights will be justifiable. First, we need to look at the nature of the right or rights that will be affected by such a provision. In this case, as indicated, the proposed provision is likely to affect the rights to privacy, dignity, and equality of persons listed in the register. In Benston and others versus Vesta NO and others, the Constitutional Court explained that the right to privacy consists essentially of the right to lead one's life with minimum interference. It also concerns, and I quote, honor and reputation, avoidance of being placed in a false light, and non-revelation of irrelevant and embarrassing facts, close quote. While the information that will be made publicly accessible is indeed relevant, it will undoubtedly affect the reputation of the registrants and place them in a negative light. Therefore, we also need to look at the link between privacy and dignity. In the Kumalo case, the court also held, and I quote once again, no sharp lines can be drawn between reputation, dignity, and privacy in giving effect to the value of human dignity in our Constitution, close quote. The provision that the personal details of persons listed on the register must be made publicly available would therefore not only violate the right to privacy by revealing one's criminal past, but it will also infringe on the right to dignity and likely result in community ostracism. Furthermore, Clause 7C will also violate the offender's rights to equal protection of the law, as it distinguishes between offenders convicted for sexual offenses against children and mentally disabled persons and offenders who may have committed similar offenses against adult women. What then is the importance and purpose of limiting such fundamental rights? According to Clause 8 of the Amendment Bill, the purpose of the register is to ensure the protection of vulnerable persons from sexual offenders. Therefore, public access of the register is imperative for the prevention of contact between potential victims and sexual offenders. However, SIFAC raises concern that the objectives of making details of the register publicly available may come at too great an expense to the implicated individuals. The nature and extent of the limitation is such that it will effectively punish offenders who may already have served their sentences. Furthermore, public criminal records will have a negative impact on the reintegration of offenders into society. Not only would their prospects of employment be limited, even in cases where they don't have to work with vulnerable persons, but these offenders will not be welcomed back into society, as citizens residing in an area where a sex offender is registered will fear for their safety. We then need to consider whether there is any relation between the limitation of fundamental rights and the purpose of publicizing the register. Evidence from states that have taken the measure of publicizing their sexual offense registers indicate that this does not prevent the commission of sexual offenses. Although policies of this kind are popular and often called for, they are not efficient, effective, or equitable. In South Africa, where only a small fraction of reported sexual offence cases are likely to result in a conviction, public access to the register is likely to create a false sense of security among citizens. In an earlier report, the South African Law Reform Commission warned of a real threat that communities might take the law in their own hands and cleanse neighborhoods from offenders, even on the slightest of rumors. It should be noted that the Law Reform Commission conducted extensive research prior to the implementation of the current register that is in effect, and they found that publicizing the information of convicted sexual offenders would pose a real threat to such offenders. The final question is whether there are any less restrictive means to achieve the purpose.
When you round up, you have 1 minute.
Thank you. So we submit that while there are many high-risk sexual perverts that need to be closely and consistently monitored by law enforcement, there are less intrusive measures that can be taken to control sex offenders and achieve public safety. For the sake of time, I won't go into details on such measures. However, SIFAC does not support the publicizing of the register for the sole purpose of blaming and shaming sexual offenders. While we acknowledge that public access may encourage vigilantism, this measure cannot be justified constitutionally. It has no rehabilitative effect, and its deterrent value is suspect and will likely give citizens a false sense of security. Therefore, in concluding, our submission is that the parliament or lawmakers should instead focus on addressing current administrative challenges faced in the implementation of the register in its current form. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, ma'am. I have noted the following hands: Honorable Noma Themba Maseko Jele, Honorable Kobu Dile Tshwantshe, Honorable Nevoet Drakens, Honorable Jacqueline Mofokeng. Any other hands? Let's take those hands in that order. Honorable Maseko Jele.
Thank you very much, Chair. Also, thank you very much to the presenters. Only have one clarity question. So the first one is about the public reporting, to hear their views on this one, because this one also might come with its own threat when it comes to the people from the community reporting such acts to the police. I'm saying this, Chairperson, for example, there has been allegation in the community that people sometimes they call the police, report activities, crime activities in the community, and that information leak, and it's an allegation. It does look when you find
that those people... Honorable, tell you some question, can you mute yourself?
Yes, I'm sure that at some... let me say it comes back and haunts them. I want to hear your view on that one. Saying that information leak and you find that the person who has been reported to the police comes back to you and say, when you reported this matter, and now that person is now, it becomes a threat to that person. That is number one, Chair. And then the last one is the issue of, I want to hear their view on this one that they've just spoken about. The last one, the register, that they're against this information from the register to be publicized. I just want to find out from them, have they considered, with all that said, I respect the decisions of the court and whatever the views that they have given, but I want to hear the other side. Have they considered the right of the victim vis-a-vis the right of the perpetrator on that issue? And then again, have they maybe not see this as a detergent to at least to make, I don't know whether it's the right way to change it, like something that will make people not to commit this act. It's you know, use this register and the information given to the public to make those who might think to commit the act of GBV not to do it, knowing that the community will know about them. I want to know their view on that one, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janje.
No, Chair, thank you. I think I did not lower my hand previously, so thanks. I'll skip this.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mfuke.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. Maybe I should also say thank you for the spiritual abuse that you support, that it should be included. Chair, I have one question. It's on the disciplinary action of SAPS, South African Police Services members. I hear that they have a problem of implementation, but now they are suggesting that the oversight role should be done by the Gender Commission. And then the question would be, why not the Independent Police Investigative Directorate? Thank you.